Wherever you are, we are. Your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Today is Tuesday, August 5th, 2014. This is News One Now with Roland Martin. Certainly glad to be with you on this day, the 5th of August. Hope things are well in your world. Lots of things happening in our crazy, crazy world. And so, again, glad to be with you. It's always great to be with you, whether you are listening on the radio, in your car, in your home, whether you are listening via the Black Planet Radio app or the TuneIn app. It does not matter. We're just glad to be with you on this particular day. Hey, yesterday we talked about, of course, the U.S.-Africa summit that's taking place in the nation's capital, and lots of different things going on here. And but you know what's interesting? If you want to understand American mainstream media, just look at the amount of coverage this summit is getting. I know some folks say, oh, man, these things happen all the time, but this is the first of its kind. We talked about 6 of the 10 fastest growing economies in the world right now, African nations. You would think it would mean more than just a blip on these 24-hour cable networks. Maybe if they stopped spending so much time fixating on who was going to run in 2016, they actually might cover what's happening in 2014. Just a thought. Just a thought. And so we are certainly doing that. Later today, we're going to hear from National Security Advisor Susan Rice. She is the former United Nations ambassador, but she also, when she was in the State Department, was over African Affairs in the Clinton White House. And we are going to chat with her, talk to her about the Africa Summit and the economic opportunities taking place. Let me tell you something, what's happening right now. CEOs have been clamoring to get to this particular summit, the various dinners taking place. Walmart has said that Africa is at the top of its list in terms of expansion. You are seeing companies who understand how the continent is changing and are not locked into the way things have always been, the way things always will be. And so it has been very interesting just looking at how this is being covered, how it is being treated in media. And so that's one of the things, of course, we will be looking at and focusing on today as well. Also, also on the show today, I'll be chatting with Jessica Gorton Nimhardt. She's a book out. It's called Collective Courage, A History of African-American Cooperative Economic Thought and Practice. And if anybody who understands the history of black folk in this country, so much of our development has been based upon cooperative economics. And that is, being able to assist one another, help one another. And it was extremely popular during the early to mid part of the 20th century. It is in many ways how African Americans were able to survive the Jim Crow era, able to survive during the Reconstruction era, able to survive after slavery. The idea of cooperative economics and literally how we operated when it came to food, when it came to jobs, when it came to clothing, when it came to shelter. And so I'm going to talk to her about that. It's a really, really interesting look at our history in this country, and it really speaks volumes to how African Americans operated in terms of working together in order for us to survive in the United States of America. So we'll talk about that. But also, when we come back, though, I want to deal with this notion of am I the only person who also can't stand rude people? Man, I'm talking about rude. Just rude folk just get on my last nerve. I wrote a piece for the Daily Beast just talking about how just rude people really get on my nerves. And so I want to talk about that. I want to get y'all thoughts on that. And how do you deal with it? Because some folk I just really wanted to throw an elbow at or just cuss out. That's just me. That's just me. So I don't know how you operate, but that's just me. So we'll talk about that today as well. But coming up next, we'll chat with Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr., of course, founder of Rainbow Push. We talk to him every single Tuesday, and we'll do so today. It is Throwback Tuesday right here on News One Now. This segment of the show brought to you by McDonald's, Kevin Lyles, Reverend Al Sharpton, and the Yonla Van Zandt. Also, Wheel Power Packer, my homeboy, producer behind Ride Along, as well as Think Like a Man. These are only some of the names of this year's McDonald's 365 Black honorees. Tune in on August 10th on BET at 9 p.m. Central Standard Time, 10 p.m. Eastern for the McDonald's 365 Black Awards. Folks, 7 after the hour. This is News One Now. Rolling Mike.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number 2, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now. With Roland Martin. Roland Martin.
14 after the hour. Welcome back, News One Now. 14 after the hour. Welcome back, folks. Of course, Throwback Tuesday. Rubber Band Man, the Spinners right there on News One Now. Hey, as I said, taking place in the nation's capital right now is the U.S.-Africa Summit, where you have the largest collection of African leaders ever assembled in one location, certainly the first time in the nation's capital. It is a historic gathering that was called for by President Barack Obama. And economics is the motivator for all of it. Joining us right now, of course, every Tuesday, we talk to Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr., founder of Rainbow Push, in our weekly segment. But a lot of people may have forgotten that under the presidency of Bill Clinton, he was a special envoy to Africa. Reverend Jackson, how you doing?
Good morning, Roland, and it's been a tremendous gathering of Africans here at the state for the first time in American history. To go from slave trade to a discussion about fair trade in the capital is a long journey. As a matter of fact, we've not arrived at free enough fair trade yet, but we're in that direction. Europe is the number one trader with Africa, part of its post-colonial history. And now that China is investing so heavily, America is somewhat embarrassed into reassessing how it relates to the most productive and the most endowed continent on Earth. So I think China's a big factor in this conference, really.
You know, I'm glad you made that point. I remember a couple of years ago, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton had made a point about, African nations being, beware of all of the investment in China. I remember reading that story, and I said, well, you know, how dare America tell these African nations beware when it's not like America has stepped up when it came to the issue of investment. When we often think about Africa, it's typically a conversation about food. It's typically a conversation about famine. It's typically a conversation about medicine, opposed to
present Africa as a basket case. In fact, is the bread basket of the world in ways other than just food. The African Union Center built by China in Ethiopia makes the United Nations look like a Hotel Six. I mean, it's built by China.
Reverend, hold tight one second. We have your line is not a clear line. No, let's see if we can fix that. Let's see if we can reconnect. It is not clear at all, so it's very choppy. So we'll try to reconnect with Reverend Jackson to have a clear line so we can hear him. If you listen to what Reverend just said in terms of Africa being not a basket case but a bread basket, there's opportunity there. And a lot of us, I mean, anybody who understands the history of the Reverend Leon Sullivan, what he was able to do, what he was able to do when it came to connecting African Americans with Africa in terms of being able to do business, being able to establish diplomatic relationships. These things were critical to the growth of many, many Black-owned businesses across the country in establishing those relationships across the world. And all too often, folks have overlooked the value, the importance of the continent of Africa. And it does require us to have a different worldview. Reverend, we have him back on the phone line. You there?
Yes, I am.
All right, that's much clearer. All right, so you were talking about Africa being a breadbasket.
Yeah, we see Africa, you know, unfortunately, in such negative terms. First of all, if you and I left Kennedy Airport, one of us going to West Africa, and one going to L.A., we get there about the same time. We're just that close. The great trade route where the Atlantic and the Indian Oceans kiss and at the base of South Africa, the greatest trade route in the world. The most endowed continent, the most diamonds, the most oil, the most gold, the most uranium, most of the stuff used in our cell phones, social media, come from Africa. And so while we've seen Africa as some place to give advice and some aid, China is engaged in more robust trade, and I think we feel that. And now there's a sense that we see Africa, six of the top 10 fastest growing economies in the world are in Africa. Six of the top 10 fastest in the world are in Africa. And so I think that beyond issues like Ebola, issues like AIDS, Africa has a lot more to say.
You know, I'm glad you made that point because, unfortunately, right now, it is unfortunate that you have this Ebola breakout, this Ebola outbreak taking place right now with these African leaders here, because that gets so much of the attention, and what it does, it reinforces this narrative that that's what Africa is all about. Reverend, I want you to address that, and we'll pick up on this when we come back. Going to a break right now, folks. We're talking to the Reverend Jesse Jackson, Sr., founder of Rainbow Push, about the U.S.-Africa Summit taking place right now in the nation's capital, the first of its kind, the largest of its kind, 20 after the hour. This is News One Now with Roland Martin.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
25 after the hour. Welcome back, News One Now. We're talking to the Reverend Jesse Jackson, Sr., about the U.S.-Africa Summit. And, Reverend, before we went to the break, I raised the point that I thought it was unfortunate if you have this Ebola outbreak taking place right now. You have an American doctor who is on U.S. soil in Atlanta being treated. Another American who's a nurse there working with Samaritan's Purse is on her way back to the U.S. as well. That what that does is the amount of coverage the American media, the mainstream media, gives to the Ebola outbreak and therefore ignoring the actual U.S.-African summit reinforces that narrative that Africa is simply a sick continent in need of our assistance.
Well, it's interesting. Between Guinea and Sierra Leone and Liberia, that is one relative to a small corner of Africa, the African continent. You know, if you and I left New York, one going to Senegal, one going to L.A., we're that close to West Africa. If you got down to Ghana, you'd be close to New York and you'd be to South Africa. You can put America, China, and Europe and Africa have some land space left. It's a big, big place.
Right.
And our maps often distort that reality. You know what I mean? The Ebola outbreak in that zone does not affect trade with the sub-Saharan countries because it's thousands of miles away from sub-Saharan Africa, for example. So I'm glad it's being addressed because it does symbolize there is some unfinished business of poverty and sickness and illiteracy in Africa. That's true. But the Africa's rising growth is becoming a great phenomenon of the world. It used to be a competition between U.S. and Russia and the Cold War in Africa. Now the trade war between U.S. and China and Europe, and that's a good sign. U.S., Europe, and China now competing to trade with Africa, which gives African leaders far more economic options than they've ever had before.
How do we also ensure, Reverend, that in this conversation about trade, that it doesn't become a situation where Americans, just like other people around the world, view taking from Africa as opposed to giving to or investing in?
Well, that was just a junior's point. Africa needs the same trade deal that Europe has. It needs to be two-way trade and not just trade. We've gone from slave trade now to moving towards free trade. We must also speak of fair trade. Europe has been trading, but it's been colonial trade, exploitative trade, one-way trade. And you have a body of leaders now in Africa who are far more educated, far more sophisticated, and demanding new formulas for trade. So you have people at this conference here in Washington, their line up, their lips are just dripping to do a trade deal with Africa. But it'll be done on terms that'll be beneficial, mutually beneficial to those countries. People like Nkrumah, who saw this thing 50 years ago, those guys get eliminated because they shut their man early on and they get a good price for their product. I think the president deserves special acknowledgement for convening all these African heads of state in America for the first time. I think it's a big step in the right direction.
And of course, for folks who did not catch that when you said Nkrumah, Kwame Nkrumah, of course, who was the leader of Ghana when they gained their independence more than five decades ago. Reverend, when we think about if you had to begin the listing, if you will, of various countries there that are on their way. Obviously, we know about Ghana. We know about South Africa. But what are some of the surprises that you're seeing? Countries that may not get the level of attention, let's say even of a Nigeria, but that are doing very well.
Well, Tanzania is on the way. Gabon has discovered oil, for example. There's more oil discovered in and around Africa now than the Middle East, for example. So oil is very much in the Guinea, is very much on the way. All that sub-Saharan region, Morocco, is very much on the way. And so one sees in those countries did not get the kind of attention in Nigeria and South Africa yet. They're very much a part of the, Guinea. And New Guinea very much where Secretary Ray was. They had dinner with the President, Mr. Condi, last night from Guinea. One sees in those countries real development and growth, and of course stability in Liberia. Given the years of warfare there, Liberia has become a much more stable country and is growing as well.
Reverend, one of the issues that the President talked about when he visited not only as a U.S. Senator but also as President is that these are also countries that are going to have to deal with the issue of corruption in terms of leadership, in terms of democracy as well. And a lot of people, I think, overlook the fact that many of these countries were born out of revolution. So you had individuals who were military leaders who then ascended. That also has to play a role in this as well, that plays a role in terms of the growth of these African nations.
It has to play a role of giving them advice about corruption. When you think about the U.S. unilaterally going into Iraq, killing all those people and taking us from budget, surplus to budget deficit, that's morally corrupt too.
Right.
Think about the banks that went down in this country because they engaged in violating home foreclosures with subprime and predatory lending. We had to bail the banks out to save our entire economy. That's corruption. So we're not in the strongest position to lecture them on corruption. We just hope they'll have transparency and be open and fair. We're not in the strongest position to lecture people, frankly, about their behavior. We should be good, solid trading partners and ask of them and ourselves transparency in trade.
All right. Reverend Jackson, we certainly appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
For those who want more information about this, at Rev. J. Jackson on Twitter and follow me on Facebook, like me, Reverend Jessel Jackson Sr.
All right, sir. We certainly appreciate it. Thank you so very much.
Keep dancing, rolling.
All right, will do. Folks, coming up next, we'll chat with one of the attorneys for the family of Eric Garner to find out their thoughts about the medical examiner ruling his death a homicide. That is up next right here on News One Now with Roland Martin on Throwback Tuesday.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with Roland Martin. Roland Martin.
22. Before the top of the hour, welcome back, News One Now. Many of us were shocked to see the video of New York Police Department employing a chokehold against Eric Garner of Staten Island, taking him down. He eventually died. Police tried to suggest that he died of a heart attack, but the medical examiner, what they did was they ruled that no, his death was a homicide as a result of the chokehold. Joining us right now to talk about that is the attorney for the family of Eric Garner, attorney Michael Hardy. Michael, welcome to News One Now.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing great. How did the family feel when the medical examiner came out and basically confirmed what many of us assumed, that it was the chokehold that caused Eric Garner's death?
Well, the family was, in the words of the mother, you know, she was happy that God was acting in the right way. Of course, you know, they're very saddened by the fact of the loss of Eric Garner, and the ruling of the medical examiner now provides the legal basis for the authorities to go forward with the full-fledged investigation. And frankly, there's probable cause now for the arrest of the officer for having caused the death of Eric Garner.
You and I both know this. We've seen numerous cases, where police officers have been involved in the deaths of various individuals. We can think back to the Oscar Grant case in California that, of course, many people know about after they saw the movie Fruitvale Station. Is it your belief that the officer or officers involved should be charged with murder, or do you believe that what typically happens, you have prosecutors who say that's a stretch to make, they would rather go with lesser charges? What charges does the family want to see pursued against these officers in the death of Eric Garner?
Well, I think the family wants to see either the Department of Justice or the Staten Island Richmond County District Attorney's Office pursue a full and thorough investigation. You know, there are, you know, the video clearly shows what happened. In New York City, chokeholds are illegal. Under police procedure, chokeholds are illegal. And not only are chokeholds are illegal, but police procedure commands that any other officer at the scene has a duty and an obligation to intervene if another officer is using excessive force. Now, you know, as you know, Roland, the elements of intentional murder, manslaughter, criminal negligent homicide, I mean, I think those are things that I think prosecutors have to look across the board, get the facts that a grand jury will, in fact, indict on, and that you can be successful in a prosecution. We have demanded that the Department of Justice take jurisdiction over the prosecution. We have learned in the past that, frankly, no matter what the charges are, it is very difficult to convict an officer, no matter how strong the evidence is. What we have found in situations like Abner Louima, where the federal government prosecuted the officers there, prosecuted others that were involved in the Louima matter, and Justin Volpe to this day is sitting in a federal prison. We saw that with Francis Lavoti, who was acquitted in New York State but convicted under the federal charges with regard to the chokehold death of Anthony Baez. So I think a lot of the details of what is the best charge, I think the prosecutors have to sort through that. I think the family wants an honest investigation with the most serious charges that are applicable when you look at all of the facts and context.
What do you make of the young man who shot the video that we all got to see all of a sudden being arrested on gun charges?
Well, I think, again, the important thing is he shot the video. And one of the points, and one of the points that Reverend Sharpton made is as a citizen, he saw an act happen that was wrong, and he shot that video. And but for that video, we might be in a very different situation with regard to the death of Eric Garner. Now, we also know in these kinds of cases, which are very high profile, and sadly on some levels, when police officers are the potential targets of a criminal investigation, naturally, you know, that blue circle closes, and sometimes you have a misguided effort. It's unclear whether Ramsey was targeted. I mean, the facts of that situation will also come out. The bottom line is that that video has been established. The acts in that video have now been confirmed by the medical examiner. And Ramsey Orter, in terms of any potential being a witness in the future, his main role will simply be to validate, you know, that he shot the video. And so, you know, I think we often see witnesses and people attached to situations like that occasionally feel harassed by mm-hmm. police. But we have to see what the facts are there. But the one fact that is not in dispute is that Ramsey did shoot that video. The video speaks for itself. The medical examiner has now confirmed the acts on that video as homicide.
Michael Hardy, we certainly appreciate it. Thanks a lot for providing us some of these details. And certainly our prayers go out to the family. And we definitely desire justice, the same as they do, in the case of the death of Eric Garner.
Well, Roland, thank you. And thank you for all your work.
I appreciate it. Thanks a lot. Folks, up next, I'm talking about this whole idea of how are we so rude today? And do you think people today are far more rude than they've ever been? I'll explain when we come back. 15 before the top of the hour, this is News One Now with Roland Martin.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
9 before the top of the hour. Welcome back, News One Now. If there's one thing that really gets on my last nerve is having to deal with rude people. How many times have you been in a store and you're at the grocery store and you're looking at an item and you're standing in front of the shelf and somebody just walks right in front of you and don't even bother to say, excuse me. When Blockbuster had all of their stores, same thing. You'd be sitting here looking at movies and stuff. Folk just walk right past like you don't even exist. The other day, we do our show here at NBC Newstown, okay, in D.C. So I'm leaving, and these three folks are coming in. Now, I'm courteous. I open the door, see they're coming in. I hold the door open for them. Three of them. Not one of them could manage to say two words. Thank you. Three people. In fact, one of them could have took one word, the other one could have took the other word. One could have said thank, one other could have said you. Nothing. Does it tick you off when you come up against rude people? Y'all know I fly a lot. I fly a lot. So I'm at the counter, and the woman is helping me with my ticket. And this had happened so many times before that I just finally got sick and tired on this particular day. So the lady's helping me with my ticket. And then now I'm standing right there. She's helping me. Woman comes up. Can you tell me where I need to go? Blah, blah, blah. I said, hey, you gonna have to wait. Can you not see that she is assisting me? The worst, I was in Target in Chicago. And this dude just rolls right in front. I mean, not even excuse me. So I followed this punk behind around the store. So at one point, he's buying something. So y'all, let me tell you how far this dude went to be so rude. So he was walking back, and his cart was over here. He went to get this item. So he's walking here. So he had to, in essence, walk between my cart and another cart and the shelf. So what I did was I just nudged my cart forward to create as little space as possible to cause homeboy to say, excuse me. No, you know what he did? Dude literally twisted his body like a pretzel to fit between my cart and the other cart just so he wouldn't have to say, excuse me. Now, people kill me, I'm telling you. How do you react to rude people? Give me a call, 877-373-9766, 877-373-9766. And what's the rudest city you have lived in or you know of? Love to get your thoughts. I'm Roland Martin. This is News 1-9.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News 1-9. With Roland Martin.
Roland Martin. News 1-9. Does it perturb you? Does it perturb you to deal with rude people? I'm talking about rude people. I cannot stand rude people. Rude people gets on my last nerve. Rude people drives me crazy. Rude people I want to straight up cuss out. I just can't stand rude people. They just get on my last nerve. How do you deal with rude people? Did you check somebody? Have you checked a rude person? And how did it go down? 877-373-9766, 877-373-9766. Let's go to Atlanta, listening via WAOK. Fred, you're on News 1-9.
Hey, Roland, how's it going?
All good.
Hey, Roland, man, you know, I know you're talking about rudeness, and are people suffering from problems with their vision? You know, one of my things that irks me more than anything else is when I'm at a supermarket, in the lines of the parking lot, they have, you know, the one-way arrows. They're pretty plainly drawn, and people just arbitrarily drive up the wrong way or down the wrong way and block traffic. I don't understand that they don't, I mean, they wouldn't do that on a one-way street, but they think it's perfectly okay to do it in the parking lot. You know, just certain things like that just really irk me. Or, of course, you know, what we're supposed to be notorious for, talking in the movie theater. We went to see the James Brown movie on Sunday afternoon. And as a whole group, people walked in, they're in the middle of the movie just talking loud, blah, you know, I mean, it was amazing. And these are older folks, you know, these are like some elderly people. Maybe they're confused about when the movie time started. But so things like that. You know, I mean, do unto others as you have them do unto you. And I think the world will work a lot better. I don't understand why people can't seem to get that.
All right. I appreciate it, Freya. Thank you so very much. Number to call is 877-373-9766. 877-373-9766. Let's go to Joseph calling from Boston, listening via the internet. You're on News 1-9 with Roland Martin. What's your comment?
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Oh, I couldn't hear you because my phone is the internet. I'd like to comment on the rudeness, but if you don't mind, after that, could I comment on President Obama and the African summit? I think there's a fine line between rudeness and just the law of nature. Just by living in different parts of America, like how in the South they like to tell you good morning, how are you? I thought it was cool. But then growing up in New York, I found out I'd rather the New York way. If you don't know me, don't say hi to me. Don't say nothing to me. Don't look at me because you could be planning some negative stuff on me. I went to a Christian conservative school in West Texas. Not that I'm religious. And the thing they like to do is Church of Christ. What they like to do is hug you. They don't even know you, but they assume you're an athlete, so they want to hug you. And I find out that I thought it was cool in the beginning, but I realized it's just a fake. It's like a plastic smile. They'll hug you and talk nice to you, and behind your back, they'll stab you. So I think a lot of time people think New Yorkers are rude, but New Yorkers are not rude. They're just trying to bring out the best in you. It's a big city. We don't know who's who. So the best thing to do is leave me alone. Don't say nothing to me. And real quick with that connection, there's a big psychology study done where somebody was dying on the street in New York, and he was asking for help. And people just walked by him. They walked over him. Because the reality is you don't know if it's a set up or not. You're just trying to protect your life. So it's very tricky when you talk about rudeness. And if you don't mind, President Obama summit, I think it's a good thing. I think when President Obama had the State of the Union address and he wanted to invest $7 million into Africa and running electricity, I think it's a good thing. But I think the problem wrong with America, the history of America, they like to dictate to people about what's right and what's wrong.
Okay.
About this. Okay, have a good day.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Number to call is 877-373-9766, 877-373-9766. I really, for the life of me, I don't understand why folks have to be rude, why they always have to be rude. It just gets on my nerves. I mean, just gets on my, just seriously. Thank you. Excuse me. Sorry about that. My bad. Pardon me. Yeah, I want y'all to break this down. Excuse me. Two words. Pardon me. Two words. Thank you. Two words. My bad. Two words. Sorry about that. Three words. It's not like we're talking about a dissertation. So do you believe that rudeness is the byproduct of parents not forcing their children to be considerate? Give me a call, 877-373-9766. 877-373-9766. How do you deal with rude people? 8 after the hour. This is News One Now with Roland Martin.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
14 after the hour. Welcome back, News One Now. Rude people. How ticked off do you get with rude people? 877-373-9766, 877-373-9766. Henry, are you forgetting something? You're supposed to go be getting me something. White, go. Yeah, see, sometimes you got to get some good help, you know. He's supposed to go get me something and he forgot. It's like, I'm telling you, I need some good help. I need some good help. Let me tell you what happened recently. So I had a couple of my nieces and nephews visiting from Houston. And we have the tutors for my nieces who live with us. They were also babysitting. So they were, you know, taking care of everybody. I was traveling. My wife was out. So my nieces and nephews know better. So, but it just kept escaping them the idea of saying thank you. So the tutors were fixing breakfast, lunch, and dinner, all that sort of stuff like that. So they got tired. The teachers were like, well, man, it's doggone, tutors were like, it's a doggone shame. These old rude kids. I said, stop cooking. They said, what do you mean? I said, stop cooking. So that's what happened. 5 days went by. They ain't fixed breakfast, didn't fix lunch, didn't fix dinner. So first couple days, you know, it was all right. You know, kids eating cereal. Then all of a sudden, yeah, they fix something else. Then by that third day, they like, they ain't cooking anymore. They were eating cereal for three meals a day. They were sitting here eating sandwiches or whatever. And then finally, all of the nieces and nephews got together to have a meeting and said, we obviously messed up. So they went to them, they had to apologize, sorry for our rudeness. I said, that's what you do. So the same tutors were saying, man, these kids are rude. I said, next time y'all go somewhere, I said, go outside. I said, lock the car door. He said, what do you mean? I said, you get in the car and lock the car door. He said, what's that going to do? I said, it's going to make them fools apologize before you unlock their door. See, I believe in punishment when it comes to rudeness for family members. Your thoughts about rude people. Reverend Pless, Atlanta, Georgia, listening via WAOK. You're on News One Now. What's your comment?
Hello?
Reverend, you on the air?
Yes. Roland, I've got to agree with you 100%, man. I don't know what it is. I think we have forgotten in today's generation how to be courteous. And sometimes we act like that being courteous takes away from our manhood, or it takes away from the individual, or it hurts us to say please or to say thank you. even when you're in traffic, when you're traveling in traffic and you're driving down the road and you put your signal on to go left or right and you give enough time for that signal or to let the person know in front of you or behind you that you're getting over, sometimes we're like we're taking something, or the other individual acts like they're being, something is being taken away from them, even in traffic. So I think we have a long way to go, and we need to start teaching people how to say please and thank you and being courteous.
I appreciate it. Thanks a lot, sir. I appreciate it. Thanks a lot. Let's stay in Atlanta, listening via WAOK. Keith, you're on News One Now. What's your comment?
Yeah, hey, this is Keith from Atlanta. I would just like to say, when talking about rudeness, I would think this kind of new generation of young black women are some of the most rudest people I've ever seen in my life. They're very rude to service industry people. You open a door, they act like you were supposed to open the door for them. I never hear thank you or anything like that. So I don't know what it is. It's the new generation, it's the TV, but that's you talk about rudeness. There you go right there.
All right. I appreciate it, Keith. Thank you so very much. Let's go to John, coming from Orlando, Florida, listening via the internet. John, you're on News One Now. What's up?
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing great.
Yes, I just want to say, with that African and U.S. summit in Washington, D.C., I'm wondering, will African Americans benefit? And when I say benefit, what I mean by that is, are we going to use this leverage to help us stop police brutality? How can you send businesses into Africa and then brutalize Africans here in the United States?
Well, first of all, there are African American businesses who are participating in the summit who are engaging in direct discussions about economic trade and businesses with various African countries.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is the masses, unemployment among black youth.
What are you talking about? Are you talking about what, sending black youth to Africa? I mean, what's the point?
No, what I'm saying is, with that U.S.-Africa summit, and if whatever businesses, I think I heard $14 billion deal so far, how is that going to relate into African Americans' youth here in the United States?
It's called, if you have black businesses who are doing business with African countries, they're more than likely, if they're increasing their businesses, they're likely going to be able to hire more people, and they can actually hire youth.
Okay, let me just say this, and then
okay,
I'll let you go.
I got to go right now. I got to go to a break right now anyway. Sorry, I go to a break. So, folks, this segment of the show brought to you by Bahamas.com. ACCU football in the Bahamas. Don't miss the first HBCU Classic to be held outside the U.S. Central State versus Texas Southern University, September 12th through the 14th. It's better in the Bahamas, folks. Go to HBCUXClassic.com. HBCUXClassic.com. 20 after the hour. This is News One Now, Roland Martin.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is, when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with Roland Martin. Roland Martin.
26 after the hour. Welcome back, News One Now. The rudest city you have visited. What perturbs you about rude people? I remember taking the train from Houston to New York. Houston to Chicago was great. But the rudeness, the weirdness kicked in when we got to Chicago all the way to New York. Felt like family going from Houston to Chicago. It wasn't that feeling going from Chicago to New York. Rude folks kill me. Vincent, Lithonia, Georgia, listening via WAOK. You're on News One Now with Roland Martin. Rude, what drives you crazy about rude?
You talking to me, Ro?
Yes, Vincent, go ahead.
Oh, okay. I guess it's the family, the closeness of the family that has gotten. You there?
Yeah, Vincent, of course I'm here.
The family, my family has, they've gotten so close to rudeness, you know, just not those simple things. Like you said, I think if you made that list out, what you had put out there and all those things, because those are things of thoughtfulness. I'm going on 60 years old. And when I grew up, and my first grade of school, I was taught thoughtfulness, just those simple things there, those simple kind things. And today, it's not happening. One reason, even more, because corrupt communications causes corruption. And we have 24 hours a day of corruption being spilled out. So, you know, I try to take time around the table and talk to my immediate family and those about those things there. But what ticks me off is, just like I said, it's so close to home now, and I got to do those things to make those corrections.
All right. I appreciate it, sir. Thank you very much. Let's go to Paris, calling from Washington, D.C., listening via WOL 1450. Paris, you're on News 1 Now. What's up?
Yes, good morning, Roland. What I noticed in the last few years, and this is mostly among younger people, as soon as you you're walking on the sidewalk, as soon as you make eye contact with them, you know, instead of them saying hello, they will spit right in your face. And I've talked to other friends, and they find the same thing. It happens so often. It's amazing. I don't know.
Oh, y'all had somebody spit in your face.
Yeah, as soon as you make eye contact with them, instead of saying hello, as soon as you make eye contact with you, they just spit in your face. It happens so often, man.
No, I ain't never had that experience, bro.
Check on that. They keep your eye open for that. You'll see.
I ain't never had that experience. All right, I appreciate it. Thanks a lot. Let's go to Jihad, Atlanta, Georgia, listening via WAOK. You're on News 1 Now. Jihad?
Yes, how you doing?
Yes, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning to you. How you feeling?
Great.
Good, good. Hey, my question, I want to comment on both topics. The gentleman that just asked you the question about the employment
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, and your response to him. I think his question was legitimate, in my opinion.
Okay.
And my opinion is,
hold up. We're talking about which? What are you talking about? Which topic are you talking about?
We're talking about rudeness.
Okay, go ahead.
I think your response was rude. I wanted to explain how I thought it was rude.
How?
I think that his question was, because of the enormous unemployment among black people, and especially black males, he wanted to know how would this particular meeting make a major dent in that employment.
But that wasn't his question. What you're doing is you are rephrasing his comment to fit what you think he was talking about.
Okay, what did you think he was talking about?
I don't think he knew what he was talking about.
Well, your response to him was, you're going to employ some black people.
No, that's not what I said. Now, if you're going to dare quote me, I advise you to quote me correctly. What I said is, this is a summit that is taking place between world African leaders and also business leaders. Because he also said, first he said, if you remember, how are African Americans going to benefit? That's what he first said. And I said, there are African American owned businesses participating in the summit. Then he Then he rephrased it by saying, "How the black youth going to somehow benefit?" And I said, "Well, what do you mean? The black youth are going to benefit because the reality is that if you look at who is likely going to hire them, it's going to be those same black-owned businesses. If you're able to grow the 1.9 million black-owned businesses in America and folks are able to do business with various African countries, then they're able to grow their revenues, they're able to build capacity and able to employ folks."
And basically, that's what he wanted you to respond.
Well,
to
no,
this.
But here's the deal, though. And I responded. But the first thing is, we were no longer talking about the African summit. That's the first thing.
So he wasn't free to talk about the African summit anymore. That was
Have
that out.
Well, hold up. You do know in radio, you do switch topics. Like for instance, for instance, right now, yes, I got an author coming up talking about collective empowerment. But again, I answered his question. He wasn't clear. Now, here's what happens. So again, if you're not clear, and I'm trying to understand you,
I thought he was quite clear.
Well, okay. Well, you thought it was
clear. I thought that his emphasis was on the large amount of black employment and how would this gathering of black leaders and black business people impact the high unemployment rate among black people.
But first of all, that's not what the summit is about. And that's actually not what the question was about. He didn't even mention black. He didn't mention the high rate of black unemployment.
Yes, he did.
Okay. All right.
But let me get
okay.
to the second point.
No. You don't. Here's the deal. You get to the second point, you run out of time.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
You use all your time on his. You use all your time on his point.
I apologize. Much love, man.
No. I'm just saying. You use all your time on his point. You should have focused on your point. Folks,
that was good. Both were good. Much love, man.
We're gonna
work this out, Roland. We're gonna get
it. It's
along.
All good. Much coming love. Up next, Jessica Gordon Nimhard, the author of Collective Courage, right here on News One Now with Roland Martin.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
22 before the top of the hour. Welcome back, News One Now with Roland Martin. Black collective economics, black folks coming together to build organizations, businesses, schools, and churches, played a large role in our ability to survive slavery, Reconstruction, and Jim Crow. Jessica Gordon Nimhard has chronicled the history of black collective cooperation in her new book, Collective Courage, A History of African-American Cooperative Economic Thought and Practice. Jessica, how you doing?
I'm great. Good morning.
All right, let's talk about this here because I've read a number of different books, historical books over the years. And I'm reading right now Barbara Ransby's book on Ella Baker.
Yes.
And I've read so many others. And this whole notion of a collective, that we're not operating as individuals, but we're simply a collective in terms of a family unit, in terms of a street, a neighborhood, a whole community. And actually, frankly, shared resources for the betterment of the entire group.
Exactly. Yeah, so I was interested in that because I wanted to solve problems in communities, right, especially in black communities. And I came across the co-op model and was trying to figure out why black community didn't seem to be using the model. And it turned out people didn't know about the model, but thought that black people didn't do that kind of economic cooperation. And then I said, that's not possible. So I started looking into history, and I found way more of this history than I thought. And I also found out that most of our black leaders, especially by the 20th century, were somehow promoting co-ops, but usually quietly. It wasn't the thing they were known for, the thing that got them press. So even Ella Baker, right? Ransby has some of this in her history, but I also went through Ella Baker's papers when she was head of the Young Negroes Cooperative League, and she really cut her teeth on co-ops, and then all the other things she does afterwards almost seems like they come because of that relationship,
right,
to her notion of grassroots collective work.
So for somebody who's listening or watching, what really is a co-op? What is it actually? How is it defined?
Right. So a cooperative is actually an internationally recognized business model, and it's an organization or enterprise business that is formed by people to satisfy needs and run democratically. So the way to really understand it is if you think of a share corporation, which is our regular capitalist corporations, they're run by shareholders. The shareholders have a vote for how many shares they have. So basically, if you have the money, the 100 shares or enough money to buy 1,000 shares, you get 1,000 votes. In a cooperative, it doesn't matter how much money you invest.
Mm-hmm.
Each person that invests or each person that's a member has only one vote. So that means there's a lot more democratic participation among the owners, and the purpose of the co-op is not to give everybody an extra profit, but just to do the mission of the business.
So give me an example of successful co-ops today, because when you read about a lot of these co-ops, historically a lot of them failed. They were not able to sustain themselves. Do we have successful co-ops today?
We do, but I do have to stop you for 1 minute. I tried in the book to not have us talk about failure, but to have us talk about change and transformation.
Mm-hmm.
So even the co-ops that quote-unquote failed, some of them lasted 18 years, so I'm not even sure why we say they're a failure, except that they ended, right? Some of them lasted only 18 months,
mm-hmm,
but they all had purposes that they achieved, even though they weren't necessarily long-lasting. So like in Milwaukee in the 70s, there was a taxi cooperative called Apex Cab. So they only lasted 18 months, but what they did was they did several things. They showed that a group of black taxi drivers could own a business together. They had people going into the black neighborhoods where none of the other taxis would go, and showed that you could actually make a business out of that. What happened was they couldn't afford the insurance. The insurance companies upped the insurance on them, and so they had to disband. So there's lots of those kinds of issues, and a lot of things that I call sabotage. So a lot of the co-ops also didn't last because white competitors didn't want them to. Oh. But now, to answer your question, we have co-ops, food co-ops, credit unions, farm co-ops. There's Indian Springs Farm Co-op in Mississippi that actually has been in existence, I don't know, I think over 20 years, and they provide produce to the Mississippi casinos, in addition to helping other neighborhood groups to farm and to farm sustainably and that kind of thing.
Hold tight 1 second. When we come back, I want to talk more about that, but also how someone listening could actually start one of these to get it going. So, folks, we're talking about the issue, the book Collective Courage, A History of African-American Cooperative Economic Thought and Practice. It is 16 before the top of the hour. This is News One Now with Roland Martin. Back in a moment.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now. With Roland Martin. Roland Martin.
11 before the top of the hour. Welcome back, News One Now. We continue our conversation talking with Jessica Gorton-Emhart regarding the book Collective Courage, A History of African-American Cooperative Economic Thought and Practice. Now, you said credit unions, that's a co-op?
Yes. So credit unions are a kind of consumer cooperative. Basically, consumers come together because they want affordable and quality financial services, and they create a co-op, which
that's why credit unions typically it has to be like a sort of a group. So, like, I'm a member of Texas A&M Aguiland Credit Union because I'm a graduate of Texas A&M.
Right.
So
they start usually with what's called a common bond.
Okay.
Now, some of them, we've expanded the law so you could have more like a geographic common bond, but they started out originally unions, universities, that kind of thing.
I worked with the Fort Worth Telegram with an employees credit union.
Right, exactly.
Gotcha. Okay.
So that's a kind of co-op, and the point there is that you pool your resources, meaning your deposits, and that allows the co-op to then give you financial services and loan you back the money to the community.
Gotcha. All right, then. Well, mic falling off is always a problem here. So, all right, so let me ask you this question here. So, somebody out right now, they're watching, they're listening, and they say, okay, I want to try this thing. I want to try it, whether it's food or whether it's some other kind of co-op. How do you start? Is there like a manual or something
that you get? Absolutely. There's lots of manuals, and there's actually lots of support out there. Basically, I would say there's three important things to start with. One, you need the people with the energy and the interest. And usually that's why we say co-ops start with a need, because if you need healthy food, you might start a food co-op. If you need access to financial services, a credit union.
So places out there where they have food deserts, they don't have a grocery store.
Exactly.
Gotcha, okay.
Right. So you come together about a need. Every co-op that I found that I talk about in the book started with a study group, meaning people came together, studied about first their problem, the alternatives, and then specifically co-op economics. So they either taught themselves or brought people in or read books about it. Nowadays, we actually have people who can train you, give you the co-op 101s, who can help you do feasibility studies because it's a business, right? Mm-hmm. So you need to do the business modeling, the feasibility study. Then once you have that, again, you need to make sure you have a coherent group to do it. You need some financing. The other thing that's great about a co-op is you start with everybody putting in a little bit, but they don't have to put in a lot because you're really pooling resources and minimizing risks. Then you take what equity the members have put in, and you can leverage that to get other loans or grants and things to do the startup. But there's lots of co-op development centers around the country that people can get connected to.
What when you did your research, what surprised you the most when you went through and realized all these different co-ops that were taking place all throughout the South and the North and the Midwest, all across the country?
Yeah, so that was my first surprise, is that there were just so many. I really, when I started this, I was thinking it was a two-year project. I would find a couple of examples, be able to say, at least we tried, you know, that kind of thing. I didn't realize there was this whole long, successful history. And then I didn't realize how many of our leaders were involved. I didn't really realize that the Black Co-op movement was really simultaneous with the whole long Black liberation movement, the Black civil rights movement.
Wow. Well, certainly, again, I've read any number of historical books, and it's very interesting how a lot of those you'll hear about these various co-ops, and folks will be surprised that so many of our ancestors really were able to get through as a result of this whole notion of a collective group being able to help support and sustain one another.
Right. And various things, like we had the Colored Merchants Association, which actually was individual Black grocers, but they came together as the CMA in order to buy in bulk, to do their advertising and all that kind of stuff, because they couldn't compete with the chain grocery stores as individual Black stores. So that's one way where they actually own their own businesses, but then use the co-op to enhance that and to help that. Then you get other groups who actually came together because they had nothing and no other options and had to share, even trying to get health care. We have health care kind of co-ops, and really any gamut you can think of, we had some kind of co-op for it.
Folks, the book is called Collective Courage, A History of African-American Cooperative Economic Thought and Practice by Jessica Gordon Nimhart. We certainly appreciate it. Thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
All right, folks, at the top of the hour, we'll talk with Susan Rice about the U.S.-Africa Summit taking place here in Washington, D.C. Also, Deborah Owens with our Wealthy You segment. She lays out why you need to stop buying all those dadgum lottery tickets and learn how to use that money to build and create wealth. Also, State Senator Vincent Hughes of Pennsylvania will join our news panel, and his wife, Shirley Ralph.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Today on News One Now, from the slave trade to fair trade, the U.S.-Africa Summit could open new doors for American and African businesses. The National Security Advisor for President Barack Obama, Susan Rice, joins me to explain. Pennsylvania State Senator Vincent Hughes fights back to get more money into his schools. We'll also, he'll join our news panel. Plus, financial guru Deborah Owens with our Wealthy You segment, saying it's time to stop buying lotto tickets and use that money elsewhere to build wealth. Also, actress Shirley Ralph talks about her role as Claudette on the Showtime series Ray Donovan. All that more coming up right now on News One Now. Folks, today is the second day of the U.S.-Africa Summit, where more than 50 African leaders are in the nation's capital talking about what should be a partnership between the U.S. as well as Africa. It is a historic gathering, unprecedented gathering of leaders from all across the continent. And, of course, oftentimes we talk about the issue of food and medicine and health, but this is really about how do we advance the issue of economics and fair trade. 6 of the 10 fastest growing economies of the world right now are in Africa. And so what could that mean for U.S. business? What could it mean for African Americans as well? But we're joined right now by Susan Rice, National Security Advisor. She also, of course, former U.N. Ambassador for the United States as well. How you doing, Susan?
I'm great, Roland. How are you?
I'm doing great. Always good to chat with you. I mean, this really is an important gathering. It's interesting if you watch mainstream media, it's as if this thing is really not happening. You've seen some stuff back and forth, but this really is something that could be a game changer, in the words of Valerie Jarrett, senior advisor to President Obama.
Well, you know, Roland, this is... It really is, as you said in your opening, extraordinarily historic. Never before has the President of the United States hosted African leaders from almost 50 countries from all over the continent. And these 3 days of meetings that will involve African leaders, civil society, business leaders from both Africa and the United States, faith groups, everybody, is really about taking the U.S.-Africa partnership to an entirely new level. We have great ties of history and culture. We have ties of commerce, but those ties can be much, much deeper and stronger. And rather than China's approach, where they come in and extract resources and bring Chinese labor to Africa and leave nothing valuable behind for the people of Africa, the U.S. approach is totally different. We're about building partnership capacity on a basis of equality and mutual interest and mutual respect. And so the kinds of investments that we're making in Africa's future, in agriculture, in health, in power, in trade and investment are unprecedented. And today, Roland, the president will make some very powerful announcements about ways we will deepen our engagement on all of those dimensions.
You, of course, saw a lot of this up close and personal when you were with the State Department in the Clinton administration, specifically involved with overseeing African affairs. And that was important because, again, when you talk about the growth, you see it happening not just in Ghana, but you also see it happening in other places. Nigeria is one of those places. Obviously, was happening in South Africa. Earlier, I had Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr. on the radio show, and he talked about what's happening in Tanzania. So a lot of times the amazing things happening there don't get quite the level of attention as we see when it comes to an Ebola outbreak or some other sort of catastrophe that happens. There are amazing things happening in various African nations.
That's absolutely right, Roland. And in the mainstream portrayal of what's going on in Africa, there's still too much domination of the negative side of the picture. Yeah, too many Americans still think of Africa as a place of conflict, of famine and disease. That has some elements of truth to it, but the overwhelming story is one of the world's fastest growing points for business and trade. As you said, 6 of the 10 of the world's fastest growing economies are in Africa. There's a vibrant, energized, extremely talented youth population that's yearning for entrepreneurial opportunities, yearning for better governance, yearning for leading their countries into the future. And so there's a great deal that's going on that's exciting. And part of the purpose of this summit is to show America a different kind of Africa, an Africa that our competitors around the world, whether the Chinese or the Indians or the Turks or the Brazilians, have long discovered as a very lucrative market. But the United States and our mainstream portrayal of Africa have to some extent not fully awakened to that opportunity. But what is great about this summit and great about today, particularly with the U.S.-Africa Business Forum, is that we have some of the United States' leading CEOs, some of Africa's leading CEOs and entrepreneurs coming together to build new ties and to announce new links of trade and investment.
And of course, Susan, as you're talking right now, we have a live feed going from WhiteHouse.gov of the U.S.-Africa Business Forum. Michael Bloomberg, he is speaking as we talk to you as well. And so we want to share some of that with our viewers and as listeners as well. Susan, on that point, I think you just made a really critical point when you talk about U.S. business leaders. In talking with other White House officials, what they say is that out of all the various ventures that have gone on, more American business leaders have wanted to participate in the various dinners as well as the meetings of this summit than anything else that has happened in recent memory.
Well, I think that's true, Roland, and it's a testament to how exciting not just our corporate community finds this event and this opportunity, but Americans from a broad cross-section of civil society, of our Congress, faith leaders. Africa has thankfully been an area of longstanding bipartisan cooperation. And so this is something that brings everybody together rather than perpetuates division. So it's more than oversubscribed. And of course, when you have 50 heads of state, almost many of them accompanied by their spouses and partners, that already accounts for a large share of the tables at any dinner or any event. And then we have sought to be inclusive of members of Congress, the business community, civil society, faith leaders, everybody. So it's a very exciting period, and we're all very much looking forward to today's events, as well as the actual meetings among the heads of state in a formal summit setting tomorrow.
All right. Susan Rice from the White House, National Security Advisor, always a pleasure chatting with you, and certainly good luck to you and the others involved in this U.S.-Africa summit.
Thank you, Roland.
Thanks a bunch. Folks, coming up, we'll talk with our news panel about various issues, including the U.S.-Africa summit. Also, we'll chat with on the issue of education with Pennsylvania State Senator Vincent Hughes. Deborah Owens here with our Wealthy You segment. She says, forget the lotto. You need more than a buck and a dream to build real wealth. You don't want to miss that. Plus, Cheryl Lee Ralph talks about the show. Great show. I watch it all the time. Ray Donovan on Showtime. All that next on News One Now. It's 8 after the hour. This is News One Now. Roland Martin on TV One.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number 2, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with Roland Martin. Roland Martin.
In a new manufacturing plant near Lagos. Because when P&G expands in Nigeria and elsewhere, it supports thousands of jobs at home. These deals and investments demonstrate that the time is ripe to work together as partners in a spirit of mutual understanding and respect, to raise living standards in all of our nations, and to address the challenges that impede our ability to develop closer economic bonds. Make no mistake, our economic and commercial partnership is a two-way street. Goods and services exports from the United States to African markets support roughly 250,000 jobs here at home. As Africa's middle class continues to expand, we hope to see our export numbers grow too. And through Select USA, the administration is actively encouraging African companies to increase their presence here in the United States. Closer economic
folks, person you're watching and listening to is Penny Pritzker. She is the Secretary of the Commerce Department. And, of course, she is addressing the various folks gathered at the U.S.-Africa Business Forum. It is the second day of the three-day the summit. And folks from all over the country, again, are involved. And yesterday I had meetings at the White House. And they said that business leaders, as I talked with Susan Rice about, business leaders in America have requested to be at this summit, at these various dinners, more so than any of the state dinners they've actually had since the president has been in the White House. I want to talk with this with our panel right now. We have Senator Vincent Hughes from Pennsylvania, state senator from that state. Also, president and CEO of Global Policy Solutions, Dr. Maya Rockamore, as well as Dr. Chris Metzler, of course, Georgetown University. Folks, all glad to be with you. It's very interesting, and I make this point. It is as if this summit is not taking place if you watch mainstream media. And it's amazing because there's never been a summit like this anytime in our nation's history. And when you look at the potential that is there between the partnership economically between the United States and the continent of Africa, the upside is huge. It is amazing. Senator Hughes, as a state senator, you also understand these relationships, the various trade partnerships with various African countries. To our folks listening and watching, why is this summit critically important to any African American?
Well, Africa is really, in many respects, rolling the wealth of the world, right there, right in front of us. We've been there several times, participated in the Leon Sullivan African-American Summit. To have 50 countries represented with either their presidents, senior leaders, is really unprecedented here in the States. What we hope that this does is create an environment where, you know, states have their own trade missions also. And what we want to have is an environment where the federal government kind of lays out the groundwork so that states can follow up with their own particular trade missions and their own investments in Africa so we can really double down and really have the kind of partnership that I think we've all longed for but never really realized. Now's the time to make that happen.
So, you know, in 2000, I was Mr. Rangel's chief of staff, and I participated in the passage of the African Growth and Opportunity Act, which is the first ever trade legislation between the United States and the countries of sub-Saharan Africa. And it was our philosophy at the time that Africa has huge potential. And instead of having an aid-donor relationship, we had to have a partnership relationship, looking at Africa and them looking at us as trade partners. And so what this is a continuation and an extension and a widening, if you will, of that relationship in a positive way. Africa is not only the future, it's the present. African countries have double-digit growth in many African countries with regards to investment and returns. And so many multinational companies are looking to the nations of sub-Saharan Africa for their huge potential for investment. And also, we should be looking for the reciprocal relationship with indigenous African country, African companies actually doing business with the United States as well.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the narrative about Africa versus the so-called BRIC countries, because when we talk about BRIC, we're talking about Brazil, Russia, India, and China. Somehow we've forgotten to put Africa in there, because to your point, as we look at to the question of economic potential and economic growth, we're really not paying any attention to that. I mean, that is not the future, it's the now. Africa is not the future, it's the now. And so, but what has happened is, to your point earlier about mainstream media, the only mainstream media that has occurred has been, there's going to be a traffic jam downtown D.C.
Right.
You know, that's been it. Rather than looking at economic growth, and particularly when we're in a point where America is starving for economic growth, this is an opportunity that is a missed opportunity, and I think it's time for us to get over that.
But it's also an opportunity in terms of for African-American businesses who have a natural kinship with the motherland. I have spent years as a journalist covering a variety of conferences and summits in Houston, in Chicago, in Dallas, and other places where the folks have tried to foster those relationships. And it's simply a matter of us not sitting back waiting and saying, no, wait a minute. We got brothers and sisters who are looking to do business with us, but we got to be able to also say, let's do business with them.
Right. It is, and you have to persevere. This is not a transaction that is going to be automatic. The potential is huge. The upside is huge. And it really is an environment in Africa and many of the countries where there's extreme opportunities for being really creative in doing things. There's some environmental challenges in parts of some of the countries in Africa. What about creating some innovative zones where you can come in and do some really clean environmental development in those areas? Really tremendous opportunities. We see it. We want to encourage it, and I think this lays the groundwork.
And Maya, I got to say this here, because my folks prepared for me that they had a soundbite from John Kerry. They were talking about food issue, and I said, we're not using that, because I'm sick and tired of having a discussion about African nations, and it's one that's talking about food, it's talking about water,
right?
It's talking about whales, it's talking about medicine.
Right.
When what we should be talking about are cell phone companies,
right?
Talking about telecommunications, talking about software.
Right.
Nigeria has an explosive, I was talking to Tim Reed about this, an explosive movie industry.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we have the usual Africa conversation, then we're sort of falling into the same trap.
That's exactly right. And not only that, you can't look at the mainstream media and see any images of a modern country in Africa. You don't see roads, you don't see downtown buildings, etc. You only see the rural setting, people half clothed and dirt. And so, you know, I think that we're dealing on a multiple level, but I wanted to get back to something that he said.
Okay, one second. I want you to pick up on that point. We come back. I go to a break. We'll do that when we come right back with our panel folks. Of course, also coming up in the show, you want to win the jackpot in the lotto. Look, cut to the chase. You're likely not going to happen, okay? So why are you spending all your money buying lotto tickets when you could be putting that money somewhere else to actually grow and build wealth? Deborah Owens will break it down in our Wealthy You segment. Also, later in the show, we hear from Cheryl Lee Ralph talking about the hit show Ray Donovan. Why do I keep forgetting? I watch the show every week. It's a great show, Ray Donovan, right there on Showtime. And so we'll talk about that, folks. It's 20 after the hour. This is News One Now on TV One.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with Roland Martin. Roland
Martin. The capital in this country is unbelievable. And I'm a firm believer in rather than reinventing the wheel is the best combination of global and local. Global organizations partnering with local organizations like MARA and many others is the answer. A case in point is Atlas MARA, which my partner Bob Diamond and I set up a few months ago to buy banks in Africa. We raised $1 billion within 6-7 months, and majority of our capital came from the US, and majority of that capital had never invested in Africa before. So the appetite is absolutely there.
Focus, a live look at the, of course, the U.S.-Africa Business Forum taking place. There are meetings all across Washington, D.C. At various venues. And again, you have some 50 heads of state who are here in the nation's capital. I'm going to go back to our panel. State Senator Vincent Hughes of Pennsylvania. We have Maya Rockamore, President and CEO of Global Policy Solutions, as well as Dr. Chris Metzler, Professor political science at Georgetown University. Maya, you want to make a comment before we went to the break?
Right. There have been longstanding complaints that in the State Department and in the U.S. government generally, that of the five regions of the world, that Africa is five of five, that we have not prioritized the continent of Africa.
In fact, when we came to even military, mm-hmm. the Africa Command was the most recent one.
That's right.
Where we literally, and Kip Ward was the first general to lead the Africa Command. We had commands all across the globe. That was the most recent one we created.
That's right. But the interesting thing is that the BRIC countries, Brazil and China, haven't thought that way. Yeah. They are prioritizing the continent of Africa. They are aggressively moving in.
Right.
Lula, back when President Lula was the president of Brazil, he did an exchange with Africa. And China, as you well know, has been aggressive in its investments in multiple countries around the continent.
And Chris, and I remember something taking place, it was a few years ago, and I was offended when she said it. Then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton cautioned African leaders about the investment of China, saying, well, China was looking for natural resources because they were growing and then they were building things. And I said, wait a minute. These countries say we need infrastructure.
Right.
And so we're going to enter into agreements with people who are willing to make investments. We know what we have, and it's a partnership thing. When the U.S. was barely spending any money, and the money that we were spending was really dealing with the issue of health and medicine, as opposed to roads, bridges, dams, schools, all of those things, infrastructure that you need to build and develop countries.
Yeah, well, but that goes back to the mindset about Africa and doing business in Africa that we've been talking about. Look, the way that it's been programmed and the way that the narrative has been written, I think, is folks want to go into Africa and say, you know, we are your benevolent ones here to help you. Africa's not trying to hear that.
In fact, hold tight 1 second. I want to go back to this live feed. This is President Bill Clinton now speaking at the U.S. Africa Summit.
Today that I hate panels that are over-directed, and I don't like ones where the members filibuster, but I do want them to be able to say what they have to say about this issue. We all want more trade, more investment, better ties. It is generally known that Africa is going to grow as it has for somewhere between 5-7% as a continent. 6 of the 10 fastest growing economies in the world are in Africa. It may go to 7 in this coming decade. The middle class is growing. But in spite of the $80 billion in foreign investment and the $400 billion in exports we'll see this year, 3/4 of those exports are still in oil and gas, metals, and diamonds. So the potential for economic diversification is great. There are 650 million cell phone users.
I want to pick up on that point he just made there, Chris. You were making the point, and one of my and Senator Hughes to speak about that. Here you have President Bill Clinton said 75% mm-hmm. oil, gas, and minerals, yet you have other products mm-hmm. that folks are making there that people should be consuming across the world.
It's about diversification.
Yeah.
You have to diversify your economy. And I think what this summit does is allow, looking at the list of businesses who are participating, allow for folks to truly understand the opportunity for diversity. And it's there. You just can't focus on a few specific areas. You must diversify.
And look, one of the other areas that's a booming industry is education.
Yes. Mm.
Because we're seeing the building of schools. I mean, look, in many of these countries, not like what we have here, a public school system, there it's really largely private schools. Yeah. But there are other people who I know who have gone to African countries who are literally taking education models to these countries.
That's right. There's a lot of potential using technology and of course, investments in schools to really innovate in that space. But, you know, this is Bill Clinton's legacy. You know, he was the president that first, signed into law the African Growth and Opportunity Act. And so he has, of course, this is a legacy point for him wanting to make sure that it's extended.
It's certainly a legacy point for President Obama as well, because you talk about having this particular summit as well.
That's exactly right. I mean, President Obama, with his history and his family of having roots in, well, all of us have roots in Africa, but direct roots in Africa. And in that relationship, there were a lot of high expectations amongst the leaders of countries of sub-Saharan Africa for the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. And now we're finally seeing him make some moves in this space. And to be frank with you, they've been really waiting.
Chris?
Yeah, and I think it is the issue of legacy. To the point that you made about education, I will tell you that once students, particularly at the high school and undergraduate level, come to the United States for graduate education, what we notice is the high quality of education that they're bringing, making them even more competitive, particularly in the area of technology. And businesses need to pay attention to that. Certainly, you can look to India if you'd like. There's nothing wrong with that. But I think ignoring Africa, you do so at your own peril.
Chris, Maya, Senator Hughes, I certainly appreciate it. Now we want to talk about education. We'll do that because this is a critical issue here I wanted to get to. Of course, up next, Deborah Owens with our Wealthy Youth segment. We also want to go to the break, though, go back to the Africa Summit taking place. But Deborah's up next. Here's more of the Africa Summit. So go back to that, Shelley, and then we'll take it to break.
Doing this, I think it's a great step that shows the commitment and the potential that the region has. I would say to all of the, my fellow CEOs, the number one thing is get local.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with Roland Martin. Roland
Martin. Educated to be able to contribute towards, the continued growth of our economies on the continent. And so in looking at partnerships, and at Shanduka, we've been able to create partnerships with McDonald's and with Coca-Cola. That's been a key area for us. So for example, with McDonald's today, we employ 11,300 people in South Africa. And what we've done is to focus on educating and employing young people coming into our business. And so what we do is we have a significant focus on that. And so I think from a business perspective, it's important that we focus on education and empowerment of young people so that as we go forward, we have the resources that we require to push the economies moving forward.
Welcome back to News One Now on TV One. That's a live look, of course, is the U.S.-Africa Summit taking place in the nation's capital. Look, this is about economics. It is about business. It is about not just taking the wealth of Africa, but also creating wealth of folks who live in those countries. And, of course, that's a perfect segue to what we try to do right here on News One Now with our Wealthy Youth segment. And so Deborah Owens, she is back with our segment, and I'm certainly glad to have her back. And, Deborah, this week we want to talk about something that a lot of folks, if they're honest, they're involved with, and that is the amount of money that we spend on lotto tickets.
Well,
unbelievable.
It's unbelievable, but here's why we even play the lotto. We feel like, and the studies show, that the lottery really, to poor people, it makes them feel like the playing field is level, that, rich, poor, black, white, we all have the same odds of winning. However, the fact is that there is a larger propensity for poorer households to play the lottery.
Because we have folks who have this attitude of, I can't wait for my ship to come in. Folks, hold on one second. First of all, you pulled the graphic up before you needed to. I haven't got to it yet. But so let me make this point. So there's this whole notion of, wait for my ship to come in. And so, man, if once I win that lottery, it's going to all change. When the reality is, okay, your chance of winning is so small, it's unbelievable. But the amount of money we're spending on the scratch-off tickets, on the lotto tickets, is just crazy.
It's crazy. And the fact is that one out of 176 million will win, have odds of. Those
right.
are the odds on winning Powerball, right? And what we don't understand is that financially successful people, they create their own luck. And one of the ways you create those luck, your own luck, is knowing that those little nickel and dimes that you spend every day,
right.
that dollar on that scratch-off ticket, we have a propensity to play the lotto. Native Americans and Black Americans play the lotto, if they play, on average 20 to 25 times a month.
A month.
A month. So that's a dollar a day. That's what I'm saying.
So now, folks, go to my iPad, please. I can pull this up. So this is the amount of money Black folks spend the lottery each year.
Yes.
$998.
So that's a household making $13,000 plays $998 on average a year.
No.
I
need y'all to pull the graphic back up, please.
That is your lotto.
Okay, so let's go back to it. Okay, you just said the average household making how much?
Less than $13,000.
Is spending almost $1,000.
That's $3 a day on average.
So they're spending almost 10%.
That's right.
Of their income.
That's right.
On lotto tickets.
Yes. That's amazing, right? And so why are they doing that? You know, funny, I got an email rolling, and the whole issue is our belief system,
okay.
right? And so I got an email that all of these segments from a barber who said, well, you know what? I don't make a lot of money, but you're really making me believe that I can save and invest. And you can. That's the whole point of this segment, is you create your own luck,
right.
win your own lotto.
Now, and here's the deal, Deborah. Look, when I play the lotto, first of all, I even forget the doggone thing exists. So I might be in the store, then I'll be like, all right, give me two tickets and it's $2. All right, halftime, I don't even know what to do with the ticket. So I might have won something sitting somewhere. But the point, or whatever, but the point is, I look at it as, that's $2, I move on. But I'll be in the store and I'm seeing somebody pulling off 5, 6, and they're scratching right there, and they're scratching right there and scratching, and it's crazy. And so when you talk about how much you spend, so let's go to that graphic, because this is really important. When you lay out how to win your own lotto.
That's right. I mean, and look at the averages. I mean, if you're paying a scratch-off ticket, if you're paying that,
a buck.
A buck, let's just say let's say you're playing the lottery number, so you only play a buck, right? That's $7 a week. That's $30 a month. That's $365 a year. But if I were to...
Just on that, by doing one ticket every day for a month.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Now, $365, if you were to invest at that, that's about $30 a month. That could be $12,000 in 10 years if
wow.
invested in a mutual fund. And by the way, because we don't have the chart up, and I know a lot of people are going to want to know, okay, where do we invest that money? They can go right to DeborahOwens.com/news1now and get our chart where we show you
okay.
where you can invest, if it's $25, if it's $50, if it's
$100. So $5 a week. $5 we play scratch off price over the week, $35 monthly, $1,825.
So you extrapolate that over 10 years, that's $18,000. If you were to invest that, you could be looking at $35,000. And I'm being pretty conservative on an investment
right.
in a mutual fund. I'm saying, you know, a stock mutual fund historically has paid 11% right over a 10-year period. But in this case, I'm using something very conservative. So that's your lotto. That's your winning. And the key is just understanding that it's those little dollars every day that trickle out and can be the nest egg that you need to send your kid to college.
But it's also why you have to track those expenses, because you understand where your money is going. You're able to sit back and say, oh, I spent X number of dollars over here, X number of dollars over here, and now you understand where your money's going.
You do, but I mean, hey, you can just collect all those tickets that you've played.
Right.
Keep them around. Count them at the end of the month, and you'll see where your money is going. The other point that I like to make on this segment, Roland, is that you want to make this so you take that money off of the top, right?
Uh-huh.
And so when you take that money, you set up a mutual fund account that they can go and get the information at DeborahOwens.com, News One Now. You can set it up so that $30 is automatically coming out and you can build wealth that way. If you're waiting, you know, to say, I'm going to scrape up the money I have,
right,
it's probably not going to happen.
But the main thing is, stop with the nonsense of spending all your money on those lotto tickets, because, look, and I know folks say, well, let's just go for the education to the kids. Bottom line is, I call it a voluntary tax. Well, you're paying a voluntary tax, and for a lot of folks, they cannot afford to be paying that voluntary tax.
Here, last point that I want to make is that what parents need to understand is, if you give your kids scratch-off tickets or your kids are watching you play the lottery, then they are going to take on that habit as well. So kids, watch what we say, but they look at what we do. And we've got to change how our folks are thinking and believing about how they can build wealth.
Folks, pull the site up, DeborahOwens.com/News1Now. So you can go to it, get all of the tips, all information we talk about on the show, you can do so as well. But again, folks, right here, this graphic is important. $998. Folks are spending.
That's right.
Folks are spending every year in a household, $13,000. That is crazy.
That's crazy.
All right. We appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
She is the original diva. Of course, still going strong. Many folks remember her from the cast of Dreamgirls, the stage production in 1982. That's right. Before that was a movie. That was the actual Broadway production. Shirley Ralph, Jennifer Holliday. Who was the other dream girl?
Debbie Burrell.
Okay, see, my bad. I ain't no other dream girl. All right, then. She's still doing her thing. She's on stage. She's singing. She's doing her thing when it comes to fighting HIV/AIDS. But a lot of y'all have been checking her out like I have on the Showtime series, Ray Donovan. That's a crazy show.
It's a crazy
show. Here's a clip from Ray Donovan.
It wasn't me who killed him. It was Sully.
So why do you need me?
After this long, do I have to tell you why I need you? I've always needed you. I love you.
I love you, too. But I'm worried. I did what you asked. Now, what else do I have to be worried about?
Nothing.
Folks, Shirley Ralph joins us. That show, first of all, okay, here you are on the show.
Yes.
You had, so that used to be your man. Y'all had a son.
Yes.
But what's up with John Voight and the twerking? Because I'm telling you, the first season, I mean, folks were hollering with him and black women. I mean,
as he said in the show, that first season, he said, you like what you like. He likes twerking. What can I say?
What killed me in the first season, I forgot it was some white woman he was dating. He said, you know, you really ain't my type normally.
That's right. One of the Arquettes, he told her that. And she died an awful death. Yeah.
So what is it about, what you put on that boy?
You know what? I think it's got to be something called purely love, because he's about ready to try and move heaven and earth for this woman. And all she is doing is just being herself. So it's just amazing. And we don't really know exactly how it happened.
Right.
He said to me one day, he said, we just have to thank God. And I said, yes, what are we thanking him for? He said, for the magic. He said, actors don't always have magic together, and we have magic. And something about it is palpable to the audience, because they're just loving it. They want to know what's going to happen with this couple.
But also with this show, you get a side of Hollywood that's real.
Oh, very.
I mean, I've read a lot of actual news accounts. Mm-hmm. This is not like, oh, this is just fiction or whatever, in terms of the Ray Donovan character playing a Mr. Fix-It in Hollywood.
Yeah, they're real cleanup men in Hollywood. They've been around since the start of the industry. And if you see some of the storylines, you can see the older actress, how they all conspired to hide her Down syndrome daughter.
Right.
You know, the actor that has a proclivation for young things,
right.
You know, and he's talking to somebody else's young child, you know, but, you know, you keep these things under wrap because he brings in millions and millions of dollars. So cleanup people have been around forever, and they remain scandalous because people are even more scandalous. But show business is a rough business, baby. If you're into dogs, they'll give you theirs. Hey, it's rough.
Hold tight 1 second. We're going to focus. We'll have more with Shirley Ralph. We come back right here on News One Now. Again, stars in the Showtime hit show, Ray Donovan playing Claudette, a sister who puts it on John Voight. That boy don't know what to do with anybody else. Black women just got him just going crazy. If y'all haven't watched the show, trust me, go online. Him talking about twerking. Oh, I'm talking about in the library scene.
You
still
really
hilarious. I told you I watched the show. Back on News One Now, I'm Roland Martin.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
Welcome back to News One Now. I'm chatting with Shirley Ralph right here on TV One. So, all right, so you're doing Ray Donovan. What else you doing?
You know what? It's wonderful. I've been given an incredible gift as an actress. I get to play the comedy during the day and go and do the drama at night. I'm doing Instant Mom on Nickelodeon with Tia Mowry. I play her mother on Instant Mom, which is interesting because on Showtime, when I'm doing Ray Donovan, I play Pooch Hall's mom.
Right.
So look at this. I just get to be the mother of the game. Oh, look at those 6 degrees of separation. But I really love doing that. And I'm also producing a new musical off Broadway opening September 5th called Mighty Real about the first disco queen, and he was fabulous.
The all first about disco Sylvester. Queen.
Yes, and it's just amazing.
Well, we actually
make me feel. Look at that.
Well, we actually had a one of our unsung episodes on Sylvester.
You know what? No. And it's so amazing because when people saw that, they wanted to know more about Sylvester. So this is the absolute time for them to sit down and be able to enjoy it. It's the kind of show that is going to bring audiences to their feet. You know, if they can do it to that ABBA music,
right.
Wait till you hear Sylvester, baby. Mighty Real. It's just an amazing piece starring Anthony Wayne. A lot of people have seen him in Pippin and now bringing him to the forefront. I'm just very excited to be a part of this project.
So you're doing this stuff front of the camera, behind the camera, all that stuff.
You've got to diversify as a performer. You must, or you remain one thing. And I think it's all about growth. Oh, and you know what? I was listening to that lotto story.
Right.
If you're in Pennsylvania, did you know that the lotto tickets are tax deductible?
Really?
They are tax deductible. So if you're not going to listen to what she said, which is stop buying the lotto tickets, they are tax deductible.
Okay, y'all, the reason she know that, okay, because Pennsylvania State Senator, y'all, come on, put the chair.
Because I sleep with my politics.
Yeah, she sleeps with her politics.
That's right.
We had State Senator Vincent Hughes on.
That's my hubby.
From Pennsylvania. They married, okay?
Yes, they are.
So here's what actually happened, okay? He was booked on the show, okay? He was booked on the show. I got a call yesterday saying his wife coming with him. So we don't know what we to do. So Shirley wasn't actually supposed to be on the
show today,
but she just decided, look, I'm going to go ahead and come with you, and it's going to Bogard. So, and he was supposed to have his own segment talking about education.
Because it's important.
But then she just jumped in there. And you see, that's what wives do, bro.
Look, how could I not allow that to occur? This is my boo, okay? But she got into this education thing. She rocked the house in Philly. The other day we were talking about it. The governor's destroying the schools in Pennsylvania, especially in Philadelphia. We're looking at a situation where we got 40 kids in a classroom, Roland. All right? We're looking at a situation where we may not be able to start school off on time, All right, is school supposed to start in September? Might start in October. It's ridiculous, man. And this is a national phenomenon, all right, that we got to address, and we got to address it now.
Well, for one, we're going to have you back to talk about that particular issue.
Please.
But I didn't realize those lotto tickets were tax deductible. I didn't realize that.
State law, brother?
No, because that's not the case in a lot of places.
In Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania it is.
So all the people buying those tickets, say those receipts.
They need to save them and claim them on their income tax.
So if you're not going to listen to Deborah Owens about reinvesting, at least write your doggone loud tickets off.
Exactly right. But look, what she's talking about, if you can take that $1 a day and commit to putting $25 to $30 in the bank, can you do that?
I got to go. Tomorrow on the show, Akon.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.